Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Two more weeks of lectures, so we have four more lectures. Depending on where we get, I may create some optional ones so we can talk about some of your stuff. It's fun. We sort of set up a talk about, but I may or may not have a chance to do much of it in class. If we do that, it's, we won't cover that on the final, or just do the final. I have a stack of, I think, four or five regrade requests, and I'll probably get to those in the next day or two. Workshops and problem sets pretty much going straight through. We'll have a problem set due this week. Next week, class ends on Wednesday, so I probably will give you some problems that are illustrative of the stuff that we're continuing to cover and might see in the final, but I won't be taking much time. So I'll put up solutions and you'll want to spend some time on those problems, but they won't be the same drill as usual. So do you have any questions about sort of where we're headed in the game? Yes.
Sorry, I forget the final.
Yeah, the finals came. Forget now. I think it's an lower strong or something. I mean, I got it into a bigger room so we can spread out.
Okay.
And you'll have 3 hours and you can have both sides of the sheet. And I need to set up a Q&A time the day before or 2 days before or something. So we'll do all that. Anything else? Okay, and I guess, yes.
Can you request the last Wednesday?
Oh, yeah. Unless class is officially end at noon or something like that, or sometimes they do. Do they? I'll have to check into that. If they do, then maybe, well, I don't know. I'll have to see. So what I intend to officially cover for the class, today we're going to do multi-electron atoms and some of the stuff that comes out of that. And then I want to do some nuclear physics with you guys. And then beyond that, we'll play. And we'll see how much time we have to play. But that will be sort of what I'm assuming we'll have a chance to do workshop problems and problem set problems and things like that. Okay? All right. So we're faced with the fact that particles are waves, and waves are particles, and it's a big mess. And quantum mechanics is essentially the mathematical framework that you have when you try to solve for the equations of motion for a particle with mass where you consider it to be a wave. Okay, particle, you consider it to be a wave. So one of the most successful and important examples of this is when you solve for the electron in a Coulomb potential and basically solve for atoms. So in general, we have a time in a Schrodinger equation and we conserve probability. Remember that psi square is, yeah.
When we were talking the other day about the uncertainty principle, one of them was the relationship between energy and time. And this equation seems to take place in an infinitesimal period of time. So wouldn't the Schrodinger equator, wouldn't the Schrodinger principle lead us to believe that you could have potentially unlimited energy here and that assumption doesn't hold?
No, this is solving for just the spatial piece of the wave function. I mean, we may have things that evolve over time. So we didn't have to look at, but this is the spatial piece.
So rather than taking place over infinitely small time, it's...
Yeah, we think of this as more as a static solution.
Okay.
So this is quite general, and then what you do is you plug in for different geometries the potential, and you solve for it, which can be arbitrarily difficult. And of course, the one that's really going to interest us today is when you plug in the Coulomb potential and you solve it. But the Coulomb potential has a natural coordinate system, which is spherical coordinates, which I'm sure you guys have probably seen, but as you move on in this business, you're going to be doing more and more stuff in the spherical coordinates. And so that gradient, which is on the left-hand side of Schrodinger's equation, becomes quite nasty, in fact. And so the overall equation you get is pretty ugly. And you plug in the potential here, and then you solve it. And it happens to be exactly solvable, which is bad. And so it's not pretty, and it makes the life of juniors and seniors, depending on when you exactly take the next level of quantum mechanics, you'll crank out all the solutions. But it turns out that if you say that the wave function is separable in terms of a radial part and an angular part, you can actually separate this equation and then solve it. And you can solve it for the radial part, and actually you can solve it for two angular parts, the piece for the angle that does this with respect to the polar axis, and the piece that's like this. And generally, when you look at the solutions that come out of this, you think of a radial piece and an angular piece. And the actual process of solving it is a bit painful, and if you look in detail at the solutions, it's a bit painful. So I'm not really going to drag you through that, but I am going to look at some of the at sort of what comes out of it at the well, we want to see what comes out of it. But I'm just trusting and sparing you the life anyway. Sparing you the pain also means that when I throw the solutions out there, they look like magic, right? Where the hell did that come from? Well, okay, you have to trust me that you can actually solve that differential equation and you can get all these various solutions. Now, this is not so visible. I have a better copy of that on the slide coming up. But when you solve this equation, we've already looked at separable differential equations a little bit. So basically, you put in this wave function is a piece that has radial dependence and a piece that has angular dependence. And you plug that in here, and then you divide by psi of those two pieces times each other. And what you find is you'll end up with being able to separate it out into one side being having only radial dependence and the other side having only angular dependence. But they're still differential equations and they're still tied together because they're equal to each other. But you can basically set them each equal to a constant and then solve them separately. And just remember that they're always still tied together. So when you solve these things, the radial differential equation or the angular differential equation, they will work for only particular quantum numbers, only particular discrete values when you solve for psi, just like we've sort of seen for the Bohr model in the past. It just happens to work for only particular constants. And so that's the case for the radial piece. It's also the case for the angular piece. And then you have to remember that whatever those constants are, anything they're related, because those two equations are tied together. So in the end, we get a series of wave functions and a series of quantum numbers that tell us which wave functions can exist in order to solve these differential equations. And so it may sort of seem ridiculous, but you need to get comfortable with what comes out of it. So psi becomes a radial piece, and then I've divided it up into two angular pieces, but usually this is actually considered, often people consider it's just one piece, which is called psi Lm. And L and M are the quantum numbers that come out of the angular piece. And those are described by spherical harmonics if you've ever seen them before. what we'll do is actually look at it in terms of the quantum numbers and the representation for the radial piece, and then the angular piece is either tied together or extremely apart like they are here. And in the process, what you find is that you get allowed quantum numbers for energy or the principal quantum number, N, 1, 2, 3, and you can actually think of that pretty much as the Bohr N that you're used to. And it does drive the energy. The energy depends only on N, for example. That's a lot. The energy largely depends on N, but it does have N as well. Then we have what's called the orbital quantum number, and this comes in from the angular equation. So you can think of it. It turns out that this gives you this drives the amount of orbital angular momentum that the electron has. The energy quantum number, in a sense, is driven largely by the radial extent of where the electron is usually.
On a workshop, we were talking about degenerate wave functions.
Yeah.
In this sense, with the bottom three rows there, being degenerate. Since they share an end value. Or am I generalizing too much?
No. It does work that way. I'm just trying to make sure for our answer. Yeah, those are all degenerates. Of these states are all degenerates. So degenerate means that it just shares the same energy, but we'll do more of it. So then we have a third quantum number, which is called the magnetic quantum number, which you can think of as sort of a projection of the along an axis of what the orbital angular momentum could be. So there are a bunch of rules that you just sort of have to get used to. There are very particular limits in the thing. N is like the Bohr number, which can go from 1, 2, 3 on up to infinity. L goes from 0, 1 up to N minus 1. And then the magnetic quantum number goes from minus L to L in integer increments. Okay, and these are just rules you have to become used to, which is part of what the workshop and problem set is trying to get you to do. There's kind of lots of problems where you have to sort of feel your way through the quantum numbers and make sure you're comfortable with it. So let me continue on and see if we can get a little bit of a better feel for how these things fit together. I think this is just maybe a little bit more legible, a repetition of what I just had up there. So N is 1, 2, 3, 4, on down. L can be 0 up to N minus 1. So if we have N equal 1, we can have L equal 0, but we can't have L equal 1. And L represents the angular momentum, a way to think about it called the orbital quantum number. It sort of represents the angular momentum that the electron can have. And so in the lowest energy state, the ground state of an atom, I mean, if you have an electron in that lowest energy state, it has no orbital angular momentum because it has L equals 0. Okay? If you have it in the next state up, okay, the next shell, which is N equal 2, then you can have a state where you have angular momentum or no angular momentum. Okay. And then we'll look at what these look like graphically, which I think make a lot more sense than what we have written down here. But we have radial pieces, and then we have angular pieces. And notice that where we have no angular momentum, we have a radial dependence, but no real angular dependence here. These are just constants. But once you allow angular momentum in the state, once you get to L equal 1 or greater, you begin to get angular pieces coming in. So you don't have spherical symmetry anymore. In these equations, if you can see them at all, this A0 is really just the Bohr radius. And remember, the Bohr radius was specifically the radius of the N equal 1 state for hydrogen in the Bohr model. which turns out to be what pops out of this as well. I mean, what you find is that if you don't worry about the angular dependence, the radial and the end piece is close to what we have before. Which is why Bohr works pretty well. All right, so to write it up again, the red here would be the angular pieces for different sets of quantum numbers. So what this means is that you have these selection rules for which quantum numbers, what quantum numbers can be, and for every combination of the full set of quantum numbers that can exist, those are states that can exist within the atom. In this case, we're talking hydrogen atom. Alright? So what does that mean? Each of those states then has a wave function. Here is the description of those different wave functions for some of the different sets of quantum numbers. And this just goes on and on and on. They get more and more nasty. Out the farther radii, bigger, more angular structure in it. Okay, but they're also going up in energy as you go back. Yeah.
I may be skipping ahead, but doesn't the n equals 1 energy state have 2 electrons? Where does the other electron go in?
You're skipping ahead. All right, so I actually think it's a bit easier to visualize these things once you get used to it. So for L equals 0, you have no angular momentum, and so you'll have a spherically symmetric state. Okay? At n equal 1, you have basically just a spherical shape of probability density. So remember, psi squared dv represents the probability density, and what I'm picturing for you here is a graphical representation of that probability density. All right, the darker it is, the higher is the probability density. And if you you can't tell this, but this gets denser as you go toward the center. But you have, so this means in the ground state hydrogen atom, you have a probability density that, unlike the Bohr model, which just is an orbit, okay, on a circle, now you have a spherical distribution of charge, spherically symmetric, even to the extent that it has non-zero probability of being electric protons. So it's a different sort of piece. Ask me, where is the electron? It could be anywhere, because you have a non... The probability density is dropping off. This is an exponential in R over the Bohr radius. On this page, R0 is the Bohr radius. On the other page, it is A0. Arbitrary changes in terminology is a very important part of keeping people in the class. So this exponential is dropping off. So when you get very far away, when you get well outside the Bohr radius, you have an extremely low probability of finding an electron there, but not zero. So each atom has a non-zero probability of having the thing very far away. All right, so what happens when you go to n equal 2? You are again spherically symmetric because the angular momentum at n equal 2, you can have L equal 1 or L equal 0. If you have L equal 0, you have a spherically symmetric state. And in this case, you have a pretty different structure. You have something that's not so different from what we see up here near the nucleus. And then you have a region of much lower probability, and then you have a shell of higher probability that is out some further radius. Note that it is bigger now. Literally, the atom, when the electron is in that state, is literally bigger. and the energy is now different. This is the excited state. You have to give this electron energy to put it into that state. Okay, so that would be equivalent from going 4 in for 1 in 2. However, now we start to get some real differences, because at L, remember, for N equal 2, I can have L equals 1 or L equals 0. If I have L equals 0, I'm spherically symmetric, and again, you know, I have this strange structure, shell structure. But if I have L equal 1, I now bring in angular dependence. And you start to get, for L equal 1, you get this or this. If n sub l is plus or minus 1, it looks like this. If n sub l is equal to 0, it looks like that. When you go to n equal 3, you can have l equals 0, which now looks like this. You can have l equal 1, which then looks like these. Or you can have l equal 2, and now you start to get even a more complicated angular structure. Yeah.
For the n equals to 0, the fact that it has no probability, what is that space? You know, kind of looks like it has like sections cut out. Does that also mean that the probability is 0? Okay.
Yeah.
So how would it get there? You know, it's kind of a weird question, but like, how would it go from the top, let's say, to the bottom without traversing a rabbit?
You're stuck in the particle world.
Yeah, that's it.
No, you took that easily. What you're picturing here is probability density for the electron wave. If you were to demand that you ask, give it a location, in a sense, this is just the probability density of interacting with that particle at those locations. I don't know what it means to say it goes from here to here, because this is a wave probability density. So somehow the electron magically, with a probability that is proportional to the darkness here, is like, you know, well, with the caveat that they're trying to make it through me, so it's looking very dark. The electron has, you can't say anything other than you have that kind of that density. You can't say that I see in an atom that the electron is in here and I can't get to here because there's zero probability that it can go this way. That doesn't work that way.
If you were to measure where the electron was and it appears in there, and then you were to measure it again, what, like, should you be able to tell more stuff about it? And can't you just do that a lot of times?
You can map out the probability density by measuring, in principle, a million atoms in the same state. And you'll get an answer for, in principle, for each of those.
Can you keep measuring it? Like, say, here, now it's here, now it's here, now it's here, now it's here.
Yeah, if you're able to do it non-destructively, and you can keep it back in the same state, all of which is a pretty big deal, that's how you know that. One of the problems with quantum things and small things is the mere act of measuring changes things. It's just really hard to.
So when you talk about waves, you have directions, right? What about the directions of waves?
We've solved the time-independent Schrödinger equation. So what we're solving for is a probability density as a function of space and time and energy, as a function of space. But I haven't said anything about time. So it is true that I wouldn't think of these as traveling waves. Things may evolve. How do I say that? The time dependence in a system like this is more of a transition between one state and another. These states are static, that's how I think of them. But the electron can still go from one state to another.
Then what happens to the wave?
What happens is the probability density and the energy change from what you have in this one state to what you have in the other. I don't know how to visualize what happens in between. It emits or absorbs a photon in the process, which changes the energy, but I don't know what happens in between. I don't know how to visualize that.
Okay, so it's just the wave is like magically changed from one shape to another. Probably.
Yeah, I don't know that it. Well, I mean, if you can put the infrastructure underneath quantum mechanics so that you can have it be non-probabilistic, you bet you're headed to Stockholm and send me tickets. I'll come. We'll do shots. It'll be fixed. No, seriously, it's bothered everybody since. I mean, I don't. It's perfectly fair to be very bothered by that, and good. But at the same time, should you have the expectation that you should be able to mechanically make sense of it? This is well outside the regime that we basically have evolved to mentally deal with. You're living in a world where particles and waves are very different, and your intuition is driven by Newton, and we're really just in a different realm here. And the probabilistic piece works, but just like we talked about in class last time, when you try to think about what's happening during those transitions between one well-established wave function and something else, you run into these causal issues. And so you get all sorts of strange problems when you try to sort of visualize it a bit too much. So I'm not trying to discourage you from doing that. I guess I'm sort of saying I feel your pain and I wish I could help, but I don't know how. So enjoy it like the rest of us. Okay. Let's see what else we can do with this. Okay, so here's another visualization of these things. So this would be the n equal 2, l equals 0, m sub l equals 0. And you see that now we're just cutting them, and the brightness represents the probability density. So, and this would be the n equal 3. You're going up in energy as you go to each of those. When you bring in the angular dependence, here is the L equal 1 for N sub L equals 0 and for M sub L equal plus or minus 1 for N equal 2. And here you see the N equal 3s, N equal 4. And you can see you start to get all sorts of interesting angular characteristics coming in. So we're about to get there, but what are we looking at? These are the possible wave functions for an electron to exist in a hydrogen atom. The electron is not in all of them simultaneously, right? It's as if you walk into a neighborhood of empty houses and you can only live in one. So usually you'll live at the one at the bottom of the hill, so you don't have to walk up the hill. But if you have more energy, you can go up the hill and live in another house if you want. You can only go live in one house at a time. So that's what these represent. You can actually create a hydrogen atom where the electron is in some really bizarre angular state, if you will. And you don't have any movement on the side. Okay? Now, where we're headed is what we'd like to do is to figure out how to look at a multi-electron atom, because if the universe were just hydrogen, life would be life wouldn't be. It would be very warm, okay, at least for us, like we wouldn't be here. But the quantum mechanics of the simple potential is still there. So it gets a little bit more complicated because you can imagine having a positive charge in the center, and now you start adding electrons in the system, and electrons that you're adding in later, for example, effectively see a charge that's screened somewhat by the ones that are closer in than it. And the other thing is, what happens when you start adding the electrons in? Can you dump them all in the ground state, or do they have to fill the shells of some way? So, to understand multi-electron atoms, this is what should drive your intuition. But remember, it's a little bit worse than this, because all the electrons affect each other. So if we start to think about more complicated things, remember what we've got. We've got a nucleus, which is very, very small relative to the size of that we've been talking about for these wave functions. You can sort of think, I mean, the Bohr model really is a pretty good approximation of a lot of the scales that we have to deal with. So 10 to the minus 15 meters is roughly the size of the nucleus. 10 to the minus 8 meters is a decent number to use for the size of the atom itself. It is, in a sense, you can think of it mostly space. Although the electron is a wave, when you start probing it with other things and try to, we actually have no evidence for any substructure to the electron at all. The nucleus, we have protons and neutrons in them, and they have quarks in them, so in a sense, this has a lot of mass and there's other stuff in there, but the electron itself is sort of hard to pin down. At any rate, so depending on what Z is, you have different elements. And a lot of what we're about to discuss is why Z determines the chemical characteristics. When you talk about an element, generally you're talking about something that chemically reacts a certain way, and it has very particular chemical characteristics. And so it turns out that the elements are a one-to-one map with the number of Z, the number of protons in the nucleus. Generally, we say that we have an atomic number, which is A, which is the number of protons plus neutrons. No, you have a 0 point. I mean, if you have a bound, you'll have a 0 point energy. You need to calculate that and calculate the potential. Well, you calculate the wave function, it has a non-zero energy, which we call 0 point energy, and that would be true even if it has 0. So if you have the electron bound, then it will move.
But it's just lying around.
That's a good question, and I guess can you truly make it that free? But yeah, I guess the quantum mechanics of a free particle, we saw the energy goes as p as the velocity of the wave, so I guess then it sits still. Okay, So now we have all these available houses. Like we have, you know, the spherically symmetric thing. We have this stuff with angular dependence. And now we have, so for an atom which has Z of some number, it also has that many electrons because it's neutral. So then the question is, how do we put those electrons in the various available houses? Do they all go in the ground state? Do they go in some distribution? And this turns out to be really, really important. But in order to understand it, we're going to have to learn all about what I call particle promiscuity. Okay? And the way to think about it is, are these electrons, when you're putting them in these available houses, are they really friendly and everybody goes into one house? Or do they like to be separated? It may sound sort of stupid, but it turns out to be one of the more important things that we have to run into, and a big surprise. So, there was a very big surprise that came up when this guy Stern and Gerlach look at sending a beam of neutral atoms through a non-uniform magnetic field. Let's think about what they might see. If you have a non-uniform magnetic field, and you have a little magnetic dipole, it turns out you'll have a force on it as you send it through the non-uniform magnetic field. So if we say that we have a little magnetic dipole with mu sub z, okay, so we say that it has some component along the z direction, and we have a non-uniform magnetic field that varies along z, okay, then we should have a force along the z direction, which depends on the gradient and this number m. So if I had neutral atoms that I had in the L equal 1 state to begin with, then at L equal 1, they have orbital angular momentum. If you can imagine having an electron with orbital angular momentum, you can imagine it as a little current loop. That's one of the things that comes with the angular momentum, is you actually get a magnetic moment. So the atom itself will have a little magnetic moment. And what you mean when you say you have m sub l equal 1, 0, minus 1, you can think of it as that magnetic moment aligned with or against the field for m equal 1, minus 1, and sort of not with the field at all, but sort of intermediate states. That would be the m sub l equal 0 state. So what this means is that you have the atoms and you manage to arrange it so they're in l equal, they're neutral, or electrically neutral. You have them in an L equals 0 state, and you send them through this non-uniform field. If you have, then you would expect to actually see the beam split into three pieces, each piece corresponding to the 1, 0, or minus 1 component, respectively. Okay? If you were to have an L equals 0 state, so if you had hydrogen in the ground state, for example. You have L equals 0, m sub l has to be 0, it can't be 1 or minus 1, and the beam will just go straight through, and you won't see anything. Okay? So that's very clear, actually, in terms of what should come out of the quantum mechanics. So when they did the experiment, that's what you expect to see for the L equals 0 state, and then they went and did it, and they saw it split. Complete and total surprise. See, everybody's okay with the fact that the atom has angular momentum, because you got that electron in there doing its thing. And quantum mechanics is weird, so you can have, you know, you can have angular momentum, and you can sort of have it oriented along the field or against the field, and then because quantum mechanics is sort of weird, you keep getting these discrete values, so you end up with a zero in there. And at this point, everybody's okay with that. And now you've got this thing, it, by construction, has no angular momentum, which means you'll have no orbital, no dipole moment, no little magnetic field in principle. And then you pop it through this thing, and lo and behold, you have a very clear effect. And it corresponds to the atom actually having an angular momentum, where m is plus or minus a half. And so, and they're actually doing this not with hydrogen, they're doing it with an atom has equal numbers of protons and neutrons, which Carl shouldn't bother with, but there are reasons why maybe it should be. But that doesn't matter. At this point, they basically have this massive surprise. They win a Nobel Prize for it. And what it means is that the electron itself has an intrinsic angular moment and called spin. So, as if your picture of the electron wasn't already messed up enough, classically, it is as if the electron is sort of a spherical charge distribution with charge equivalent to the electron charge, spinning and creating an intrinsic little magnetic moment that can be oriented with or against the magnetic field. Yes? Well, it's not, because I'm just giving you a mental model of why it's called spin. I mean, what we know is that if I, at the highest energies you can achieve, probe it for structure, I find none. So as far as we know, it's point-like. There probably is, I mean, who knows? So right now, in the world of particle physics that we have, we think of it as a point-like particle. Nevertheless, it has intrinsic spin. So you got to be careful with the mental models, but when you want to justify in your mind why we say it has spin, it's that little mental model, because you're trying to think about how this thing can have a little magnetic moment. So you think of it as a little spinning charge distribution. So in a sense, it's called spin. But don't take that any further than that. Okay. So it turns out, with this discovery, that particles, the fundamental particles, the proton, the electron, the neutron, any nucleus, the photon, all potentially have, and they all have what we call an intrinsic spin. Sometimes that spin is zero. Right, so it has no spin. But you can assign it to zero. So basically you think of all particles as having an intrinsic spin. And it turns out to also be extremely important. So the spin is quantized. You can have zero, or you can have, so in particular units, which I didn't write here, in the right units, you find that it's quantized. It can have spin zero, one half, one, three halves, two, five halves, etc., all the way up. Why you can't have three quarters, I do not know. It's sort of like, why is the electric charge the electric charge? And it seems to be fundamental. I don't know. I strongly believe that these are very important clues about fundamental things in nature. And if you read enough, you know, crap by Brian Greene or whoever, these string theorists who think that they're onto something, they can, within their theory, sometimes actually come out of the theory, can come quantized electric charge or quantized spin. So it's not exactly like these may not be motivated, but right now we certainly have no functioning good theory as to why they are what they are. Okay. But I'm pretty sure it's telling us something important about nature. So one of you guys needs to do great things and figure it out. Even if we don't understand exactly why it is the way it is, know that this is the way it is, okay? So it turns out that if you look at the statistical analysis of particles with integer spin and particles with half an integer spin, you get completely different worlds. Particles that have a half integral spin, we call fermions. And when you look at the quantum states of fermions, you cannot put them in the same quantum state. For bosons, these are particles that have integral spin, the quantum statistics is different, and it turns out that they're very happy to be in the same quantum state. So this is really important. For a multi-electron atom, we have all of these available states, and we have a pile of electrons that want to file in and fill these states and create an atom. If electrons were bosons, the ground state of an atom would have all of the electrons in the one in the n equal 1 state. Okay. But electrons are bosons. I mean, are fermions. Sorry. So they basically successively fill the various states. But in terms of the quantum mechanics, for each house, we have the quantum numbers n, l, and m sub l. So let's just consider the lowest state level, where you have n equal 1, l is 0, m sub l is equal to 0. So you say, okay, one electron can go in that house. Turns out that the electron quantum number, the spin quantum number, also counts. So you can have an electron in that house that has spin up, you can have an electron in the house that has spin down. So for each of the states that we have been talking about, with each of the distinct sets of the three quantum numbers, you can put two electrons in with opposite spins. And we know that's the case. If you have two electrons in the n equals 0 state, it turns out that if you those spins counter align, and you have an angular momentum, a spin angular momentum of 0 in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, for example, you just go straight through. So that's an unpaired electron that caused it to split into two. Okay, so now the game to understand how the electrons fill the available wave functions, or what they're typically called orbitals. We have to use some rules. No two electrons in the same state. This is known as the Pauli exclusion principle, and chemists leave it there. It's because electrons are fermions, and I'm not dragging you through the statistical mechanics of how the spin makes that happen. You'll get that in other classes. But this is what we just said, okay? Electrons go into the state with the lowest possible energy. So for the ground state of an atom, the electrons fill the shells, the orbitals or the shell, the different levels, in such a way that you have the minimal energy. That's what you really mean by ground state. And then, interestingly, within each sublevel, so for example, at n equal 3, we know that we have l equal 2 and m sub l is equal to minus 2, minus 1, 0, plus 1, etc. So you have all these different possible levels. It turns out that those levels are at the primary quantum number level, n equal level, they all have the same energy. But what happens is that when you have energy orbitals that are available that effectively are the same energy, if you have you put the electrons, it's better to say it in a minute, never mind. Different graphics. Okay, so then if you're going to add the electrons in, increasing in energy until you use them up, you have to have some sort of mnemonic to know which energy level is lower than which other energy level. And to first order, it goes as n, just like Bohr does. So n equal 1 is the lowest energy, n equal 2 would be the next, n equal 3 would be the next. But because you get all these different levels of m sub l's and things like that, it starts to get a little bit mixed up. So a way to keep it straight is if I were to plot the energy of the different orbitals, 1s is the lowest. Oh, okay, welcome to another thing that confuses everybody. We're stuck historically with notation from the spectroscopic world. So we call the S state, L equals 0. The P state, L equals 1. The D state is L equals 2. And the F state is L equals 3. These are really just angular, different angular momentum states. And if you've never seen it before, it's sort of absurdly an absurd complication, and I'm sorry for that, but you'll get used to it. So when I say a 1s, that's n equal 1, l equals 0. 2s is n equal 2, l equals 0. 2p is n equal 1, l equal 1. Okay? On up. This is the energy order. 1, level 2, where the p is a little higher than the s. As L equal 1 is a little higher than L equal 0. Then you get to level 3, so you still sort of fit the intuition from 4. 3S, 3P, then you get to 4S before the 4B. So you get to 4S. The N equal 4, L equal 0 level is less energetic than the N equal 3, L equal 2 level. So they start to get mixed up. So to keep all this straight, here's the way that I learned how to do it way back when in chemistry. Write 1s, 2s, 3s, 4s, 5s. Then start down in a row, 2p, 3p, 4p, 5p. 3d, that should be 3p, sorry. No, that's p, it's okay. 3d, 4d, 5d, 4f, 5f. So you have to write it like this. And then the energy levels get filled. Like so. Oops, not like that. Okay, so you can sort of get this ordering by playing this game. Why do you care? All right, so just to summarize though, because you'll have to know the rules all the time. So pull it all together with skin. We have n equal 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to infinity. L, we can go from 0 up to n minus 1. Or m sub L, we can go from L to minus L and integers. And then we can have m sub S, which is plus a half to minus a half. All right? Okay. Here's why you... Now I'm going to try to paint line here. If we now take z from 1 to 11, for example, and we could go on, and I put the available states sort of like so in energy ordering, so I sort of stop here because things start to get more confusing before us and stuff. But basically, these are the available states. This would be the n equal 1 state. This would be n equal 2. This is n equal 2 with L equal 1. This is n equal 3 with L equal 0, L equal 1. And so remember that for L equal 1, I can have m sub L, which is minus 1, 0, or plus 1. So I have three different available houses, if you will, for each L equal 1 state. For the S, L is equal to 0, so I have only one house. Even for n equal 2, L is equal to 0, has only one house. N equal 3, only one house. So for L equal 0 states, you have only one house available. For L equal 1 states, you have the 3. And if you went up to L equal 2, you'd have 5. Alright? So then, we imagine as we increase the number of z, we are also increasing the number of electrons, and let's ask where they go. So for hydrogen, it's easy. It goes into the ground state. All right? And so we signify that by saying it is in the 1s1 state. So n equal 1, L equals 0, and we have one electron in there. For helium, remember, because we have m sub s that can be plus or minus 1, we can actually put an electron in the exact same state, except it has the opposite spin. So it pairs with spin, and it fills this 1S level, and we call it 1S2. When we add one more electron, and we're at lithium, for example, so these are all neutral atoms, we have what we started with the helium, and now we add one more, which goes into the 2S state, because that's the next level up. We add one more electron, it also goes into the 2S state, because that's the next level up. So there's beryllium, and you can write it down as 1S2, 2S2. Then things become a little more complicated. As we go to 5, 6, and 7, we're adding the next three electrons, and now, energetically, it's favorable to keep them as separate as you can and to keep their spins in the same direction. So you get unpaired electrons with their spin all oriented the same way. And so they go into the three different levels. These three levels are energetically degenerate. Yes?
Do you know that it fills its metal minus one person?
No, I don't know that. That's why I was saying they're energetically degenerate. Later in the class, we'll see what happens when we hit it with a magnetic field. When you hit it with a magnetic field, now you will end up with an energy separation in those three levels. And you can actually have transitions between those three levels. It's called the Zeeman effect. You can do magnetic spectroscopy that way. So these M's and L's become really important when you put a magnet on it and you start playing games with spectroscopy. So it's a very important way of trying to, you know, ferret out the structure of that. Okay, so as we fill up the P levels here, we fill them up with the electrons staying unpaired insofar as possible. So this would be a 1s2, 2s2, 2p1. Alright? And then we go on down. When we get to the next level, so oxygen, we start to pair it off with the spins going down. So 1s2, 2s2, 2p4 looks like this, where we've actually paired off in one of these states with the other two or three, etc. Okay? Get real good at that. Because it has a lot of effects in terms of our understanding of atoms. What we're about to see is, imagine, for example, hydrogen in and of itself, you have a proton holding an electron, and the electron is just sort of sticking out there, and hydrogen turns out to be pretty reactive chemically. Helium, you add another electron in. You've added a proton, so Z has increased. So it's now holding the electrons much tighter. So it's harder to do something where you're messing with one of those electrons, you're pulling the electron out. And helium is amazingly unreactive chemically. You add one more electron, lithium, you've increased the number of protons again by one. It holds those inner electrons even tighter. That outer one now is spatially has a lot of probability of being further away. Those inner electrons tend to screen the charge of the nucleus. So this one is held fairly lightly and is relatively easy to remove and react chemically. Lithium is explosively reactive. So it turns out that this shell structure explains chemistry at some level. In fact, P.A.M. Dirac has a famous quote. The underlying laws necessary for mathematical theory of a large part of physics and whole of chemistry are thus implicit in them. Tell that to your chemistry friends. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're going to... I mean, in the defense of the chemists, right, you do have emergent properties probably that are coming out, and certainly it's going to be really hard to study a dog with quantum mechanics. It's a very complicated system. But the essence of it is right here. So let's look at some of the chemical properties and how it all fits together. You've certainly seen periodic tables before. Hydrogen, lithium, sodium, potassium, etc. These all have an unpaired electron in that next n equal whatever shell. N equal 1. This is n equal 2 has the 1s electron, has had the 2s electron unpaired. This would be n equal 3. You have a 3s electron unpaired. These are highly reactive. Okay? When you're over here, these are places where you have fully just filled a P shell. So this would be 1s1, 1s2, 2s1, 2s2, and now you start to fill the P level. So you do the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. When you get the neon, you have completely filled the 2 level. These electrons are largely no further away. They're all, you know, n equal 2 electrons. They're not that far away. And each time you go up, you have added another proton, so you're holding them that much higher. So you might expect, for example, the ionization energy for the electrons to increase as you go out here. Ionization energy means the amount of energy I have to put in to remove that electron. These should be becoming more stable as I move over here, until you get neon, where it's very, very stable. So these are known as noble gases. And for example, you can use these. They're really hard to chemically react with anything. They don't do much. So you can use them as the carrier gases for other nasty things in the lab. So a lot of the structure of this, and I'm not going to get into a lot of the other things, but the form of this is really popped out of the quantum mechanical shell structure that we were just looking at. So, yeah, all right, so to give you a sense, I guess I was trying to just... Here's hydrogen, the one unpaired goes right there. Lithium, the one unpaired, right there. You go down to boron, oh, that's the P. So you go to sodium, you're now at the N equal 3 level. There you are. Okay? For the really, really... stable things, you have sort of the filled shells. So helium is filled. Neon, you have just filled the full 2 level. If you look at argon, you'll find that you've just filled the full 3 level. And those are very, very stable. Stay loud.
Yeah, I wanted to look at this. I just want to show you this. I probably have to do this. Oh my God, what do I have to do here? Press Control Delete to log on. I don't actually want to log on.
How are you showing this as well?
It's on my laptop.
Oh, it's a different computer.
Yeah, I was, and the problem is I can pull up that link on my laptop, but then I have to log into the wireless. So I thought it'd be simple because I thought we always had a... I'm trying, it doesn't recognize anything. Oh, there it is.
The
usernames and
passwords.
Your account? I'm going to complain massively about this. It's not worth our time. When you go through, you want to check this thing out. This is amazing. I have never seen this. This is a new thing. Is it? Does this happen every kiosk you go to now?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I know I can solve it. It's just not worth doing it. I can log onto my own computer. It has wireless. It just would take more time. It's just annoying. That really pisses me off. Sorry, I'm going to have to... Okay. So you can go there. This interactive site, that particular one, there are probably lots of others. You can click on the chemical element and find out lots of information about it, and you can sort of correlate the chemical characteristics that you see with the shell structure. So it's sort of fun to do. But to give you a sense about how that works, let's just think about the atomic radius. Okay. So what I'm plotting here is a measure of the atomic radius in nanometers versus Z for different atoms, okay, remember the number of electrons in the atom depends on the number Z, okay? So if we just look at basically helium going up, so if we look at these atoms, as we increase Z with the electrons all effectively about the electrons all sort of start out roughly the same distance, if you wish, and you're increasing Z, the atomic radius goes all the way down. Once you fill the N equal 2 level, the N equal 3 level has a different geometry, and you have a non-zero probability of being further away, so the average atomic radius jumps, okay? And then as you add electrons into that shell, and you're also adding more protons, they're held higher, and the atomic radius actually slowly reduces until you reach N equal the 3D, okay, and then you have another angular kick, so it gets bigger. So you can take the shell structure and begin to see things like how the atomic radius correlates from one atom to another. And that will affect crystal lattice spacings and all sorts of things. So here's another way of looking at it. You can see, for example, as you go to N equal 2, if you have one electron here, if you have two, it's smaller, but you've added a proton, so you're pulling it tighter. When you go to L equals 0, and you start adding in the keys, you're adding as one proton as you go up, and the atomic radius actually reduces all these. So you get, you can sort of see the correlation between the structure that comes out of the quantum mechanics and what you see chemically. Perhaps more importantly is the ionization energy that we have, except this is atomic radius. Sorry, this is just another picture of the same old thing. Here's the ionization energy that you get. When you talk about ionization energy, things that have low ionization energy are going to be chemically more reactive because they'll tend to be easier to remove electrons. So, again, you'll see these kinds of correlations. So for, as you go from helium, which has a very high ionization energy, as it's hard to remove one of those electrons, they're held very tightly, you don't have other electrons in there shielding them from the protons. You go up to lithium, you've now started a new shell, so you have an electron that lives further away from the 1s electrons. So it's sort of screened, it's a bit easier to rip away, and you see that the ionization energy drops dramatically as you go from helium to lithium. And this is extremely chemically reactive. And now, as I add more electrons in that shell, you can sort of think of them all effectively as being in the N equal, they are all in the N equal 2, but you're adding more protons, so the ionization energy basically goes up. And you can see a couple of glitches where you're going to the P and where you're starting to add in electrons with the parent. And again, you get the very high ionization energies for neon, etc. Okay? So out of the quantum mechanics of the Coulomb potential,
talks effectively with chemistry.
Here's just another picture of it because the web's full of them. So why not? Okay. Woo-hoo. Sorry, too much coffee. Okay, so, yeah, so what do we mean by chemistry? Well, I'm not going to do much with molecules and solid state stuff. I wish we had time to do more. But atoms can react together to create energetically favorable states. And one way to think about it is you can have sometimes transferring an electron from one atom to another. So for example, suppose you have sodium, which is highly reactive. It's highly reactive because it has this electron that's not held that tightly. It's got other electrons that are further in. So for sodium, you have a 3s electron sitting by itself. It tends to be further out than the 2s and the 1s that are all screening the charge from the center nucleus. So this electron is pretty easy to pull apart. Okay. Chlorine, for example, if we look at where chlorine is, chlorine is here. It has a 2p5. If you add one more electron, it completes that shell for chlorine and makes it very, very stable. So it turns out to be energetically very favorable for the chlorine, if you have chlorine and sodium together, for the chlorine to nab an electron from the sodium completely. And the chlorine now becomes an ion, becomes negative, and the sodium is positive, and they'll attract each other electrostatically. And you get a totally new thing. It's called table salt. It's, you know, if you were to do it that way, if you were to take chlorine gas and sodium and dump it together, I'd run like hell. But if you did, it'd be highly reactive. It'd release a lot of energy in doing this, but in the end, you would create a table salt. That's not how you want to do it.
Do not try that at home.
So that kind of bond, which joins these atoms together, literally creating a lattice of these atoms, we call an ionic bond between the atoms. So that's one form of an atomic bond. There's another type where, in a sense, they sort of timeshare an electron. So you can imagine, it's called a covalent bond. And in this case,
oops, didn't want to do that.
Carbon, for example, you have four openings in the 2p state for carbon. And it turns out that carbon will latch on to, say, hydrogen and share that electron. So, for example, you can create methane, which is CH4. So the carbon effectively shares four different electrons from four different hydrogen atoms. The hydrogen atoms don't really quite let go. It's the quantum state when you look at the whole thing. It gets distorted a bit, so that electron actually spends most of its time in between the two nuclei, and it sort of bonds the two of them together. You get a simple harmonic potential actually. So you can imagine, you can take a covalent bond like this, and you can literally model it like a string. If you have the two nuclei further apart have more electron density in between them, and they're attracted for that negative density. If they're much closer together, the positive charge repulsion between the two nuclei is greater. You have less electron density in there, and they'll tend to repel. So quite literally, you can model a bond as a string. You'll do a lot of some harmonic oscillators. You'll do new
other courses. So, at any rate, I guess I'm out of time, but that will give you a sense for sort of how quantum mechanics feeds into clearly, people do talk about molecular orbitals and things like this. So these orbitals do get things get more complicated when you start adding a lot of atoms together. And you have to do simulations to figure out what the molecular wave functions are. And that's what they do independently. But the essence of it is sort of what we've seen today. So, okay? So, yeah.